I'm Rain. I'm an alcoholic. It gives me a great pleasure to introduce this gentleman. He was present at his sponsee, who's not here, the 25th anniversary in Wilmington, North Carolina. Tom is also one of our out-of-state trustees at Dr. Bob's house, and you know, I can't say enough good things about Tom. I probably couldn't even count them on one hand. I don't know. I've been looking through all the books. I can't find a darn thing to say about him. But you know, he's got a powerful message, and I know the work he does in North Carolina, and you know, it's just I'm proud to be a friend of his. And his sponsor spoke here yesterday, and old Cease from Prince Albert. Is that in a can, or is that? Without any further ado, let's give Tom a big round of applause from Minneapolis.
Hi, friends. I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic, and delighted to be here. It struck me that I've been going to International since 65, and I'm corrections enough that I've been on most post office walls. This is the closest I've ever come to talking about corrections at an International. And in a way, that's meaningful to me. Meaning for me, because I never have wanted to be typecast and put in a box. Very important to me to be a real member of Alcoholics Anonymous, doing real work right in the heart of the program. I don't normally write stuff down, but I have to when I've got a time constraint, because I swear to God, I can talk all day, but I have a hard time with 20 or 30 minutes. And let me tell you what we're going to do. I brought a sidekick because we used alcoholic planning on putting this together. I had a 12 o'clock meeting here, and I've got a 1 o'clock meeting at the Civic Center in Oshkosh or something. No, just across the street. So all we're going to do is split the program, and I couldn't have a better partner, because if we brought all of the sobriety represented in that sponsorship line that Ray alluded to, we'd set this place on fire. My sponsor is about 48 years, and his sponsor is about 48 years and 10 days. And I'm 43, and this guy is 36. So, and there's a few more around, so we really could set this on fire. And what I'm going to try to do is set this 30 minutes on fire, not with all the wonder of it, but just trying to get through it. And so I'll probably tell you more than I know in 30 minutes. I want to do two things. One is just allude to the history a little bit, not with dates and all that stuff. That's tedious to me if it doesn't get brought to life with anecdotes. I want to share with you and then pose a question, just a little thing I picked up from GSO in the literature stuff that goes back to the beginnings of AA out of San Quentin. Well-known story. It's usually mixed up and told a lot of different ways, but it's an important story because it's where AA in prison started. And I want to read just one thing from, I'm going to read just a little bit, then I'm going to get into to sharing what I want to share about my relationship in corrections. Clint Duffy, I had the pleasure of knowing Clint Duffy. He and I did some work together years ago before he died, and what a great joy to meet that man and to work with him. He was a marvelous fellow. In March of 41, the warden at San Quentin, who at that time was Clint T. Duffy, took the great step of introducing the AA program to alcoholic inmates. From that has grown a prison program which now constitutes 208 inmate groups with a membership of 10,000. That was in March of 1953. Shortly after the start of the group in Quentin, Warden Duffy wrote the following. The repeal of prohibition did not, as many believed, result in lessening crimes directly due to drinking. there continued to be committed to penal institutions a large percentage of men, except when under the influence of liquor, were law-abiding citizens, men who lose all control over their actions as soon as they have taken the first drink, men who periodically went on drinking sprees for periods as long as several months, during which time they neither knew nor cared much where they were nor what they did. These victims of the pernicious alcoholic habit, being totally irresponsible during this period, commits acts ranging from writing checks without sufficient funds or borrowing an automobile, in quotes, to more serious offenses too numerous to mention. Sobered, they are shocked to learn they're in trouble. Their remorse is genuine, but a serious law violation or perhaps a series of violations occurred. It was apparent to us that the alcoholic presented a problem of rehabilitation which the prison program was not meeting. Our Board of Prison Terms and Paroles was well aware of the importance of continuing aid to such men after release on parole. If, as Mr. Alan Moore, State Director of Parole for California, has often said, we can keep our parolees sober, we can keep them out of jail. And I think all of us can well attest to that. And that was Clint Duffy. Let me tell you about, I'm not going to do it. I'll show you if you want to see it. There are some quotes from various wardens back in those days extolling the virtues of AA in prisons. I would simply invite you to take a look at that thing. It's in the literature. And then ask yourself one question. Would the staff and the warden at the institutions where I do service make similar comments today? Be interesting to see. One of the complaints that I get from prison staff, I don't get many, but one of the complaints that I get is that when AA members come in, they'll have a tendency to walk past staff like they're furniture and go hug an inmate. Now, we may know what that's the heart and soul of, but the guy standing there doesn't. Anyway, take it for whatever it's worth. I said I'm an alcoholic very much. And very much like Duff said, I was one of those who woke up to the realization of where I'd been way too late. Found myself in a maximum custody penitentiary, 24 years old. Looked back on a life that had happened so fast, it just seemed like a blur. I was never really conscious of who I was, where I was, what I had done, or any of that until I started to clear up. And I don't mean I was oblivious to it, but I mean that the reality of what my life was and had been just simply didn't settle in until the fog cleared. I was so busy, caught up in doing it, that I never realized I was in deep trouble till I was in way too deep. And so when I woke up in a maximum custody joint, I looked at a life that in 24 years had been about as devastating as life can get, done more damage than any human ever ought to do. Woke up to the realization I'd taken the lives of two people. And so I'm sitting in there contemplating a life that probably never should have been, and a future that looked dismal at best. And strangely enough, in that course of that experience, the brand new life started. And I wasn't even looking for one. When I sat in that place, what I was looking for was to disappear. That's all I wanted to do. I had absolutely no thoughts of reconciliation or rehabilitation or anything else. I just wanted to disappear. What I felt that I deserved to do. Oddly enough, in that setting, with that level of motivation, a brand new life started to emerge. It occurred very, very simply. I was recommended AA shortly after I got into that institution by a staff member that probably knew nothing about alcoholism. He did an interview that he was trained to do at Michigan State. He did it just like they said. And what they taught him to do was that when you see a guy with this kind of a record and it's replete with booze, tell him to go over there. Well, that's exactly what he did. More than interesting to me, that was the first word I had ever heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the first inkling I'd ever had that there was any source of treatment or help for alcoholics. It was a foreign concept to me. That was the first invitation I've ever had, and I've never had a drink since. A brand new one. Now, I didn't get healed by that social worker, obviously. But that was what opened the door about having a friend of Alcoholics Anonymous say, hey, guy, you got trouble with this, they fix that over there. Sometimes that's all it takes. It doesn't take deep-seated psychotherapy. It just takes somebody. It just took somebody that knew enough to get me pointed in the right direction, and then AA took over from there. I walked into my first meeting, Groundhog Day of 57, didn't particularly want to join, didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I was too young to be an alcoholic. I didn't tell it much, but I was way too smart to be an alcoholic. I knew that one of these days, man, this thing gonna come together. I knew that. And one day I'm gonna wake up and it'll be just a bad dream, sure. Sat in meetings of AA for a good while. Thank God, I just want to allude to a few things that were critical to my recovery. One was a strong group of AA. The group I went into at Jackson Prison over in Jackson, Michigan, was probably one of the strongest groups I've ever seen in terms of carrying out the fifth tradition. And those guys did a magnificent job. They didn't crowd me, and they didn't charge after me and get set up a special program. But those guys did a magnificent job of helping me understand the deadly nature of alcoholism. They opened the door to my even starting to acknowledge that I had it. And they did a great job of explaining the design for living that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll always be grateful to that group because they truly carried a message to me that was significant enough to turn around a life that had been like a runaway train. It was a group that had the quality of pushing me into action, which I think is critical to recovery. What our program, I've come to believe, is not about knowledge, self or otherwise. It's about experiential learning. That term's in the book at some place. Experiential learning. You know, we take the actions long before we feel like it. And that's experiential learning. And that's exactly what that group do. Nobody ever asked me if I thought it would be a good idea to go over and set up a group in the mental health clinic. They just said, that's where we're going. Wonderful group. Sometimes we'd have 10 meetings going on at the same time. Wasn't that many people, but we had multiple meetings going on. I don't know if it ever healed any of those folks, but I haven't had a drink since. Yeah, those are the things that bring about recovery. I found that guys in the joint get sober exactly the way guys on the street do. It's by getting involved in the process of taking the actions that bring about recovery, and that's exactly what happened for me. They started to follow that program, and I am Russian. You know, I'm from North Carolina. I can't even talk this fast. Matter of fact, I can't even think this fast. But some stuff started to happen in the course of that action. It's amazing how powerful that thing is. I've got a guy with me, he's probably sitting in here today, that a year ago was one of the most sad, morose people I've seen in my life. Look at that boy today. Taking the actions. I thought you were going to help out. Taking the actions started to have its effect. And I'm a great believer that Alcoholics Anonymous truly is a process. We refer to it as a journey, not a destination. I tell you this, and it's God's truth. In 43 years, I have never consciously solved one problem in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not one. Not once have I sat there and said, boy, that's it. Now I got it. Not one time. Instead, what I do is I bring a problem in. I take the actions that will relieve it, and one day I look for it, and it ain't there. And instead, some marvelous, miraculous things happen. And I just want to allude to a few of the things that happened. Most of the stuff that's happened to me of any real import happened with little or nothing contributed from me, other than just taking the actions in the program. I got highly involved in the group, as I've already indicated. I learned that somebody had invented television while I was drunk, and Michigan State University had established a campus, not a real campus, but on television. They started sending the college there. All I had to do was pay tuition, buy books, and man, I was a card-toting freshman at Michigan State. Finished 2 years of college. I tell you this, you hear some wonderful stuff today. Some of the most sage wisdom in a meeting one day. Now, I don't want to get off on other issues, but I was not an absolutely pure alcoholic. I mean, you know, it takes all kinds. But I took everything I knew anything about. I wasn't a drug addict. I was just a hungry alcoholic. I was a greedy dude. And if it didn't do anything to your head, I went for it. I didn't care what it was. One of the things I absolutely admired was speed. God, those... I'd get on that stuff and go about 4 days, and then I'd come off and just crash. I mean, for a long period of time, I'd look like a raccoon. My eyes would be so black. Well, that stuff does something to you, not just when it's in you. And for a long time, now this is not a very macho kind of a thing I'm going to share, but for a long time, I couldn't sleep in a dark room. Now that ain't macho. When you're sitting in a maximum custody penitentiary with 6,000 hairy-legged convicts, you don't want to be picked out as a wimp, you know, because you'll wind up married to somebody. So I had a problem. I couldn't sleep. If you turn the light off, I wasn't afraid of the dark, but my head would be like a kaleidoscope. I'd just see this explosion of colors, and, you know, if you get sleepy enough, you'll croak and go over. And then one day I was sitting in a meeting, and a guy said, powerful stuff. You may want to write it down. He said, if you can't sleep, stay awake. Is that great or what? Well, it's sense, isn't it? It's like most of our stuff. It ain't heavy. It's got a lot of depth to it. And I tell you the thing, when he said that, that made sense. I finished 2 years at Michigan State University while I couldn't sleep. Great stuff. A lot of miraculous things happened. When this program kicked in, I became a guy in a maximum custody penitentiary that truly knew freedom for the first time in his life, because this dude worked for me. And I became a free man in every way that matters except physical. And that's probably the least important. And experienced the first unadulterated joy and worth ever had in my life. Just simply doing these things. I wasn't campaigning for anything. I just found a solution, and I loved the solution as much as I love booze. And what happened, I just want to tell you just a couple of miraculous things, and I'm going to get out of Wallace's way because he gets mad if I talk too long. That I'm a very practical type of fellow. I like to have profound stuff about like that stay awake. And I'm a guy who has experienced some genuine miracles in his life. But I have a rather pragmatic kind of definition for miracles that explains it to me. Miracles are what happens when preparation meets opportunity. And without either of them, it won't happen. Now, God has to take care of the introduction. But it's a profound kind of insight for me about some of the things that happen when preparation. You know, if I'm not prepared, I won't even see the opportunity. And if I don't reach it, it doesn't matter how prepared I am. It's when preparation and opportunity come together. It's like getting sober. I think it requires a marvelous miracle of timing to reach that point of no return. Two times I don't want to talk to a drunk. One's when he's drinking, and the other one is when he ain't. Yeah, I like to talk to him when he's in that sort of deep, dark valley, and he doesn't care whether he lives or dies or whether you talk to him or not. I love to see a drunk in that condition. That's preparation. And then if opportunity knocks on the door, he might answer you. So stuff started to happen. I was recommended for special parole. I didn't even know they had such a thing. Happens once in 10,000 cases. All I'm doing is practicing AA. Now, I didn't make it. I don't blame him. If I'd have had a guy like me stay in front of him, I wouldn't have paroled him either. But I was recommended. What a tremendous honor. And that was an affirmation of what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. It had almost assured that I'd go out on my first scheduled review, and I did. I was 3.5 years after I went in, I was pro on condition I go to North Carolina. I wasn't too sure about that, but I was sure enough that I wanted out of that place. When I went in there, I hated that place with a purple passion. Some clowns told me that I would get used to it. It obviously takes more than 3.5 years. I hated it worse the day I walked out than I did the day I walked in. And when I walked out of that gate, deep in my gut, I had a commitment that was a no-nonsense commitment that I would never go through that again. And what I meant was not willful, belligerent kind of stuff. What I meant was that I would do whatever it took. I didn't care what it was. I meant that, and I mean that today. Well, that was important to me. When I hit the street, got immediately active, got caught up, and miracles continued to happen. I went to a prison 2 weeks after I was out, became outside sponsor of the AA group at that prison 2 months after I was out. Same period of time, many of you know. I've got a lot of old friends in here, many of you know. But I always like to tell it because I think there's a message in it. When I'd left Jackson, I had letters that big on my parole papers. This man would never drink alcoholic beverages. This man would never drive an automobile. I accepted that as a fact of life. My parole supervisor came to me one day and he said, "Tommy, you'll act and say anything." And I said, "Yes, sir." And I thought he was going to tell me to slow down. I knew it wouldn't. He said, "Wouldn't it help you if you could drive?" And I said, "Yes, sir, but I can't," as if he didn't know. And he said, "Well, let me take a look." He asked me to meet him uptown, and I walked in, and I was handed a driver's license. Didn't even take a test. I mean, written, road, verbal, nothing. He didn't even ask me if I could drive. Didn't pay for it. That's got to be against the law. There is no way. But I've been driving for a long, long time on that illegal license. I'll tell you what I really believe it is. It's just one of those miracles I talked about. That when God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. I don't care what they are. And I know that not only on the evidence of my own life, but the lives of many others. I was elected DCM, a trusted servant in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I left wondering if I'd ever be trusted by anybody. 2 years after I was out, got a phone call from the state capitol guy, asked me if I'd be interested in going to work in corrections. I wanted to ask him if he had the right number, either number would have been. And asked me, sure he knew who he was talking to. He said, "We know you better than you know yourself." 911. And sure enough, I knew deep down that that would never happen, but sure enough, it did. And I became the first ex-con in history hired in a supervisory position in a correction system. And an unbelievable thing, an unbelievable experience, and hard to accommodate. It was easy to accommodate. It was a challenge, to put it mildly. Hard to be able to talk shop when there ain't nobody else. And I loved it. I loved it. Couldn't believe how much. I didn't take a vacation for 9 years. And then after I'd been in the system a few years, one day the head of the system asked me to stop by his office. And he said, "Tom, I'd like you to take an assignment." And I said, "Yes, sir." Normally he would want me to pinch hit for him speaking somewhere. And I said, "What is it?" He said, "I'd like you to take over an institution as warden." And I told him, I said, "Boss, I don't know about that, man. I don't want to be the man. You know, I want to be mud wrestling with the guys. I don't want to be doing that junk. I want to be the good guy." And then I think I saw that with a position like that, I might be able to have some influence to do some things that I thought needed to be done, and that proved to be the case. I'm very, very grateful for that career. I'm just wrapping it up. I'll be retiring this year. When I look back on that career, I don't want to dwell on it much, but I'll just simply say that part of my legacy will be that some things changed in North Carolina that may not have changed if I hadn't been there. Probably wouldn't have changed if I didn't have this program lighting the fire to do something. And they don't recruit wardens out of maximum custody joints. I think you know that. I did bother to finish my education in correctional administration and to outwork anybody I ever met. I wasn't ambitious. I just had the zeal to do it. And what a marvelous career that's been. I want to introduce Wallace by merging over into that a little bit. One of the things that I found early on when I took that was exactly what I feared, that when you become the man, I don't care how nice you are, you're still the man. It doesn't make any difference. And I knew that when I went in, and I found it verified very quickly. because it was just routine for somebody to slide up to me with an old AA buddy and say, "Hey, wonderful to see you. Wonder if you can't do a little something for me." Well, I saw right away that I had to make up my mind if I was going to be fish or fowl. And so I made up my mind that I would take my place in the professional ranks and be the man. Now, I was pretty particular about what kind of man I was, but it was very important for me to do that. I had a young inmate walk up to me one day, and I was standing out on the front porch of the institution. He looked at me. I could tell he wanted to say something. I said, "How you doing?" He came over. He said, "Are you really the warden of this place?" I said, "Yeah, I mean, it's a dirty job, but somebody got to do that thing." And I said, "Why do you ask?" He said, "Well, I've met a bunch of them, and you just don't seem like them." I could have kissed him. And that was a high compliment, you know, because I didn't want to be off in a barrier somewhere. And so I've always had the propensity to not take the barrier too seriously. Yeah, I'm the man, bottom line. If you get out of line, I'll take you down in a heartbeat. And I think folks knew that. The folks who look gentle and lovable also have high expectations of people. But I've always had the tendency to peep over the fence and do some stuff that probably was out of character for most wardens. One of them was working with this old boy over here. And he and I met, 37 years ago, I think. And I guess we kind of sneaked and worked with each other for a long time. I want to introduce him with one particular story. I guess it's just on my mind. Experience. He tells it probably different because he's a lot older than me. But in 1965, I was going to my first international in Toronto. And I'd been telling Wallace about it. He was the artist for a publication we had. And I'd been telling him about it, sort of giving him a word picture of what it would be like. I'd never been, but I knew better than he did, I think. And so our coupled imaginations produced a center page for that publication. And it was his vision of what that would be, what it would be like. And I did something that, to the untrained eye, would have seemed a little cruel. Because I was talking with a guy who was intended to never get out. I mean, ever. So I watched him. Watched him doing that. And I said, "Oh boy, let me tell you something. If you keep doing this thing right..." Excuse me, I suddenly have a lump in my throat. If you keep doing this right, and maybe if I keep doing it right, one of these days we'll go to one of these things together. Well, now that would seem like a very cruel, excuse me, a very cruel thing to do to a guy that was never supposed to get out. But I believed that. And in 1985, 20 years later, I was getting ready to go to Montreal to our 50th anniversary. Phone rang, and it was that old ugly boy. And he said, "Hey, Chief," good, he always called me Chief, and I'm not even an Indian. He said, "Hey, Chief, good news. My parole officer said I can, that I can go to Toronto or Montreal with you if I go with you." Well, I already had my plane tickets, and it's about 30 days before I'm supposed to go. And I said, "All right, we'll get you a ticket and we'll go." And he said, "Oh, no, I can't get on an airplane, man. I'm just barely used to being on the ground." There ain't no way I'm going to get on an airplane. And I said, "Oh, God." And so I canceled my flight. And here we go, heading to the foreign country. And what a great trip. I think he was probably the most excited guy in Montreal. But the point is that what we do sometimes looks like a kind of a fruitless effort. I hear a lot of people say, "Just don't think it pays off." Doubt if you'll ever hear me say that.
Here, Chief.
If I didn't look out for that boy, he'd get lost. Been doing it for a long time. I'm Wallace, and I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety day, February 16th, 1964. I found out yesterday at 9:25 that I was to do this today. I didn't sleep very well last night. But it is good to be here. It's always good to be with AA people because a long, long time ago you became my people. You accepted me and began to care for me and show me that you didn't care about my past. That what you were interested in and what I was doing with my life today. And so far today, my life has been sober, happy, joyous, and free. I don't have long to talk. He took most of it. But I am an alcoholic, and I've been one for many, many years and had no intentions of becoming one, but I did. It's not my fault. I made a conscious decision to drink, but I did not make a decision to become an alcoholic. And I'm not exactly sure why I became one. Maybe it's genetic. Maybe I drank too much too long. Maybe I crossed over that invisible line. Maybe Mommy put me on the potty backwards. I don't know why. But I became one. And after taking the first drink of booze in 1953, I immediately began to drink for the effect produced by alcohol. I liked the way it made me feel. I liked it because, for once, I could dance, laugh, talk, socialize, dance with the big boob women, and have a ball. And I had been unable to do that prior to taking that drink. I liked everything so well the first night that I drank that I determined in my mind that I would be doing it on a regular basis. And I began to do that. And quickly the trouble began coming about in my life. And I absolutely could not stop the trouble because I did not stop the drinking. I didn't associate the drinking with the trouble. And it seems that the more I drank and the more I went out and socialized and did those things, the more trouble I got into. I didn't get into trouble every time I drank. But every time I got in trouble, I was drinking or drunk. And after years of this and going to jail for driving under the influence, after license revoke, resisting arrest, striking police officers, and doing all those things, after walking out on a wife and a baby, after destroying an army career, after losing job, after coming to in places that I did not want to be and with people that I did not want to be with, I had come to realize that I was being totally insane in many areas of my life. And during my second marriage, which was a total disaster, I began drinking again after 3 weeks of that marriage. I had sworn off again prior to that marriage in order to get my family off my back, in order to influence that lady, and in order to get her to ask me to marry her. 3 weeks after we were married, I began drinking again. And the problems began to crop up again. And a year and 3 days after we were married, and after I had been totally blacked out, drunk, and insane from Friday through Monday afternoon, offenses were committed that brought about my incarceration again on Monday morning. Tuesday morning. On Monday morning, I had come to at 5:30. My wife was vigorously shaking me, asking me, was I going to work? The weekend had been blacked out almost totally. And that Monday morning, when she shook me and asked me, was I going to work, I said yes. But when I turned to get off my bed, my elbow hit something hard on the pillow. It was 2 pints of North Carolina moonshine white liquor. And I sat there on the side of the bed that morning and began to drink. A few minutes later, she came into the room, and she was very hysterical when she saw me drink. And she proceeded to tell me some things that she had never told me before. To get out of her house, out of her heart, out of her life forever, that we were through. That she was going to work, and that when she got home that afternoon, I was to be out. And of course, I proceeded to drink that day, and went to town that day, apparently, and was told that I had been seen uptown drunk. I heard people testify later on that they would not sell me beer that afternoon I was drunk. I heard a sheriff testify later on that he had looked out his window at the sheriff's office that Monday afternoon and that he was coming out to arrest me at 4 o'clock. I was drunk on the street. But he said the phone rang and he came out. He answered the phone and was on the phone for about a minute. He came back to the door to see where I was, and I was gone. And he figured the police had me or would have me within a few minutes. And I have wished a million times plus that he had arrested me that afternoon, because sometime within the next couple of hours, offenses were committed that brought about my arrest again the next morning. And of course, I was placed in jail. No bond was allowed. That was January 21st of 1963. February 13th of 63, I stood in Superior Court in my hometown of Roxburgh, North Carolina, and was sentenced to a period of natural life, plus 40 years at the expiration. And it was 2 days later I was carried into Central Prison. Never will forget that day, that Wednesday afternoon, when they carried me into Central Prison, and they did carry me in, handcuffed between two other guys. When we got into the back hall, I looked on the wall, and there was a clock, 20 minutes to 3. The door on my right-hand side slammed shut, and when that big steel door slammed shut, a feeling of relief come over me. I was exactly where I belonged. I did not belong out here in the free society with you people. I would not have to bring any more heartbreak or shame or degradation on the name of my family. Wouldn't have to hurt anyone else again. Wouldn't have to drink again. I knew that. And I got into that institution. My head was hung real low, hurting on the inside, very, very full of pain, remorse, guilt, shame. Had never experienced feelings like that before. Afraid, but trying to put up that front that Tom was talking about. And of course, I went to work in the classification section and was quickly introduced by other inmates to some pills, tablets, capsules, and little bottles of alcohol that were being smuggled from the hospital. Immediately began to get drunk. In June, some 4 months later, went to my first AA meeting, but it didn't mean anything for the next 8 months. But on February 16th of 64, I came to in my cell block one Sunday night. Miserable, the most miserable any human being could be. I couldn't get as drunk and stay as drunk for as long as I wanted to stay drunk, and I couldn't get sober. I had no program of recovery. The only thing that made sense that night was suicide. I made up my mind that at 9 o'clock when this door slid open, I would go over the railing head first. And I took everything I had under the pillow and took that last bottle of alcohol and I drank it down and stood at the door waiting. And sometime around 30 or 40 minutes later, God in His infinite mercy had given me another chance. I came to. There was a roll of vomit from the door to the commode, and my head was in the commode, crying, coughing, gasping, choking. And inmates in the cell block on the right and on the left told me the next morning, I had cried out that night, God, if you help me get back to AA, I'll try. I went back to the AA group the following Thursday night, knowing this time why I was there. I don't know why I went in June of 63, whether it was to get coffee, donuts, see the free people, to get out of the cell block where it was 105 degrees. Don't know why I went. But in February of 64, I know precisely why I was there. I had to find relief. I went into that group desperately seeking a way and means to find relief. And even though I had been seeing Tom for several months, I had not really come to know him, hadn't talked with him other than speaking with him. And within a few days after going back to that group, Tom gave me a copy of a book called Alcoholics Anonymous and told me what I needed to do with it. And I did. I took it to my cell block and began to read it. I began to get active in the group. Began to do those things that were suggested to me by the people from the community who were coming in there. Began to set up for meetings, make coffee, began to write letters to outside people asking them to come in to speak. Became secretary of the group. Would give up my movie time on Saturday morning at the prison in order to have access to a typewriter and be able to write a letter. And as a result of getting active in that group, and as a result of finding a sponsor some 2 years later, as a result of taking step 4 and step 5 and proceeding further into the program, and as a result of finding a power greater than myself after a period of time, a psychic change took place in my life, whereby there, behind the walls of Central Prison, I found a new freedom and a new happiness. I began to walk the backyard of that prison unit as free as any man or woman out here in this community today. Because the grace of God and the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm here to tell you, is stronger than the disease of alcoholism. And it can penetrate walls that we never thought possible. And that's... And that's one of the reasons that I love you people so much today who take the time to go into those institutions and carry the message. A message that's going to save somebody's life because it saved mine years and years and years ago. And just because I got in AA and began to experience some happiness and joy in my life, and just because I got active didn't mean that they were going to turn me loose. I stayed active the entire time that I was in prison. And I only stayed in 18 years, 5 months, 26 days, and 2 hours. I got out when I was supposed to. A male member of Al-Anon went to bat for me in 1981 or 80 and began to write some letters and call the governor. And I got out on parole as a result of that male member of Al-Anon getting some other people to write letters, and over 500 letters went into the parole board and the governor's office saying Wallace would be all right if he was in the community, that he's been in a program of recovery for years and years, and that he is truly a different person. And the governor that we have today was also the governor at that time, and he commuted that sentence. And he doesn't commute anybody's sentence. If you schedule to go down in the big house, you go. None of that happens with this governor. But I can tell you, the God of my understanding can touch hearts and knock down barriers we never thought possible. I got out in 81, stayed on parole 5 years, and I've never met another inmate that had been given the privilege of building a home while he was in prison. The last 3 years I was in, I remarried because I was going out on home leave. I was working at the phone company on work release. They gave me permission to build that home, gave me permission to marry. Of course, she didn't move with me into the jail, but I did get to see her on weekends, and it was great. But getting out in 1981 was still somewhat fearful. I didn't know how I would handle this new freedom and new happiness. But I was told by my sponsor, who was a Presbyterian minister at that time and had years of recovery in AA, that if I kept on doing what I was doing, some great things would come about in my life. And they have. I have continued to be active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm one of the founding members of the Correctional Facilities Committee, along with Tom, in the state of North Carolina. I served as DCM, as State Correctional Facility Chairperson. I've been the sponsor of prison units since I've been out. The same unit that I served my last years in, I sponsored it for 5 consecutive years after I got out. Come July 16th, I'll be going back into the walls of Central Prison to carry the message, because I've been a community volunteer there now for 18 years. I keep on doing. I keep on doing what you people taught me to do years ago. I watched you when you came into Central Prison. I don't recall anyone ever pointing an accusing finger at me. The people came in and shared their experience, strength, and hope, and pointed a way out of the heartbreak, the devastation, the confusion that comes about in our lives when we go insane through the use of alcohol. Today I am continuing to be happy, joyous, and free. I retired from that job that I took on work release, working with the phone company. For 2 years after that, I worked in the DART Alcoholism Treatment Program with Tom. Had spent enough time with the state, and I'm no longer with them. I'm fully retired, but however, I do work part-time for a book company out of Ada, Oklahoma. Do it in the fall of the year because it pays good money. I like what I'm doing today. I like having a host of friends about me. I like the opportunities that have come about in my life. I sat over there last night in that stadium and looked at that massive structure of concrete and steel. 50,000 or more alcoholics there. And I thought back to 1965 when I was in that massive structure of concrete and steel in Central Prison that Tom talked about. When I drew that picture of that little man walking to the International AA Convention in 1965. Yesterday, with a sponsee I have here, we walked the walk going to the Metrodome. And I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that as long as I stick with you people, I stick with the God of my understanding and keep on walking the walk, that come 2005, I won't have to draw a picture of this little man walking to Toronto, Canada. Millard and I will get on that plane and we'll be in Toronto and we'll see you people there. I love you.